All right. So, and also, how do you spell your last? I'm going to butcher your last name. Can you pronounce it before I introduce you? I should have asked you earlier.
Patrick Renvoisé.
Renvoisé. Is that right? All right, guys. Today we got Patrick Renvoisé, author of the book Persuasion Code, but also they're really a neuromarketing company worldwide, and they own a company called SalesBrain. And SalesBrain does neuromarketing for some of the biggest companies you know. And that's all they study is persuasion, but through neuroscience, kind of coined the neuromarketing. And they do EEG studies on consumers. They, like Apple was a client, and they like test packaging with people on brain scans. So these guys don't kind of talk a lot about neuromarketing. They actually, when they have real clients, they go in there and study people's brains' reactions to things. So it's a kind of another level. I was trying to bone up on some persuasion skills, got their Audible book, and I was like walking, listening, like, this is great. Trying to get Ferd boned up, made him listen to it, bought their online course, is going through that. And then here we are, and then got in touch with Patrick, and he's agreed to host it. So he's pretty deep. And in this book club, we're going to go over, he's going to show us why we have reptilian brains. I think we all know it intellectually, but it's very different to know that we all are reptilian and to see it. So it really goes in. And then we're going to talk about three actionable things, is like diagnosing the pain. And most people are confused about what pain really means. Differentiating your claims, which most people, I think, don't do that well. And then demonstrating the game. So, and Patrick has some cool slides. So welcome, Patrick, and really appreciate it.
Hey, good morning, everybody. So let me share some of my slides. And while I am doing a few clicks to share with my screen with you guys, let me tell you who I am and what I do. So I'm a French nerd. I have a dual master's in computer science and electrical engineering. But my real passion in life, in other words, you know, what gets me going is helping other people solve complicated problems. In fact, I've been almost in the education business my entire life. My very first job is I taught physics at the university for a couple of years. So I've learned a few things throughout my life. And I'd like to share with you today in just a few minutes what took me 40 years to understand. So I hope you guys are seeing my screen properly. But I've been, you know, focusing the last 20 years of my life on the science of persuasion. So being a nerd, I wanted to really create a theory of persuasion. And that's the formula that took me about 40 years to create, right? In other words, I believe that whenever you're trying to persuade people, you're trying to sell anything, your chances to sell are equal to the pain, multiplied by the claim, multiplied by the gain, and multiplied by the primal brain to the cue. So I know it's a little complicated, so let me give you a very simple example so that you really understand how persuasion works, right? So imagine if you're selling a super simple product like water. Do we all agree that your persuasion, your probability to persuade will be equal to how thirsty people are? And that thirst is what we're going to call the pain. As most of you know, because you're very well-educated marketing people, in the past, in sales and marketing, we always talked about what people want or their needs. But we know today much better about the brain of people to say with confidence that what they want and what they need is not that important. In reality, what's important is those pains or negative emotion that will drive their behavior. Then the second factor in my formula here is how unique your water is. In other words, if you have four competitors like this, right, you divide your probability to sell by five. What? Why? Because at any point of time, any of your customers can choose any of the other water. So the more you can highlight what's unique about your water, the more chances you have to sell. Then multiply by the degree to which people will believe that your water can quench their thirst better than other waters. In other words, in this example, if you're selling Coke, Coke will not be the ultimate solution for this guy because it's too sweet to quench a good thirst, right? And then at the end of the day, you still need to multiply this by how your message will trigger their primal brain. In fact, the first three factors, pain, claim, gain, will dictate the what you need to say. And the last factor is how you need to say it. And why did we raise the factor of primal brain to the cube? Because that factor alone is as important as those three factors combined. So again, for the last 20 years, I've been using a cubic function But the more I learn about the brain, the more I believe that this should be raised to the power four or the power five. In other words, at the end of the day, how you say things is even more important than what you say. Right? So that's the theory. So there is, all these theories anchored in the fact that we don't have one brain, we have two brains. So the primal brain is located at the bottom of the brain. It consists of two major areas. One is called the reptilian brain. So this is the reptilian brain. I'm circling it, actually three areas. I'm circling the primal brain here, the reptilian brain. This is called the cerebellum. It's not a very important part of the brain, but technically it's a section of the primal brain. And another layer of the brain here called the middle brain. All this together is called the primal brain. And the puzzling discovery that neuroscientists have made is that this brain here, the primal brain, has more impact on the final decision that people make than the rational brain. So the rational brain is the outer layer of the brain here. It's what makes us uniquely human, so called the neocortex. And really the process of persuasion is a bottom-up effect. You know, when you want to persuade people, you should first communicate with the primal brain and then try to communicate to the rational brain. So this is an example. Now imagine you're trying to sell an insurance service, right? So this is the stimulus. Then that stimulus reaches the primal brain, and then guess what the primal brain does at that point? It goes, well, it's just blah, blah, I don't understand it. So people will not be excited by a message like this. Instead, if you communicate that, right, here is what's gonna happen. That's the stimulus. Then that gets to the primal brain, and guess what? The primal brain goes, wow, yeah, I'd better pay attention. So what do I need to do now? Now I need to activate the neocortex. So again, this is what the expert called the bottom-up effect of persuasion. Persuasion is about communicating with the primal brain first and then trying to influence the neocortex, not vice versa. So as you can imagine, I'm not the guy who invented all this. The origin of this is by a number of researchers, but our model is really anchored in the model of a guy by the name of Daniel Kahneman. Kahneman won the Nobel Prize in Economy in 2002. He wrote this book called Think Fast and Slow. By the way, I want to warn you, this is a book that a lot of people are talking about, but only about 10% of the people who buy the book finish it because it's PhD plus level reading. And Kahneman was a brilliant scientist, but not such a great teacher. So what he says is very complicated. You know, I probably read his book 5 or 6 times, and still now there are a lot of gray areas in what he says. But here is what Kahneman did that got him the Nobel Prize. He talks about two systems in the brain. One is called the fast brain, system one. The other one is called the slow brain, system two. Now, system one is the primal brain. System two is the rational brain. And here is what Kahneman did. He demonstrated, I mean, that's the key. It's a rational demonstration. He demonstrated that system one still rules today. In other words, I extracted that sentence from his book. System one still rules today. In other words, that the primal brain drives our behavior. Now, just a very a short list of important concepts to understand the difference between the primal brain and the rational brain. And then immediately after that, I'm gonna go show you a series of experiments that proves it, because it could be only an intellectual concept. So I really want everybody on this call here to experience what the primal brain does to themselves, right? So your rational brain is the slow brain. It's the one that makes us smart. But by contrast, the brain that we use to decide is the fast brain, but it's our limited brain. So Michael, let me ask you, why do you think that we use our fast brain as opposed to our smart brain to decide?
For survival.
Correct. Why? Because speed is more important for survival than being smart. You know, a proof of that is a fly will survive with only 20,000 neurons in its nervous system. So a fly is not very intelligent. We human beings have about 80 billion neurons in our nervous system. So our brain is vastly superior to the brain of a fly. However, flies do very well as a species. Why? Because they are smart enough just to escape our hand. So at the fundamental level of life, speed is critical for survival. So we human beings are not wired to make smart decisions. We're wired to make quick decisions. Even today in 2020, that's the point. Right? Now, our primal brain is about 100 times older than our rational brain. It's a brain that is not smart enough to work in time. It cannot project itself in the past or in the future. It's a brain that lives in what the expert called the immediate experience. And the immediate experience is a rolling window of approximately 7 seconds long. Now, it's a brain also that is not smart enough to go on and off. It's a brain that will stays always on. Why? Because it constantly has to scan your environment for danger, even when you're asleep, right? Why? Because if you're asleep in your cave and a bear enters the cave, you have to react to it, right? You have to do something about it. Or if you're a nursing mother and your child cries at the other end of the house, instantly your primal brain will wake you up, because if you don't do something to attend to the baby, then maybe baby in jeopardy, right? Then it's a brain that doesn't deal with very high level capabilities. It's all about survival, vigilance, intuition. It's a brain that hates anything novel. In fact, it always seeks familiarity. Why? Because if something is familiar, it will, you know, if it didn't jeopardize your life in the last 5 years, chances are it's not going to kill you today. It's a brain that is automatic. In other words, you have to think about it. In fact, I would even claim that the primal brain is your unconscious brain. But remember that your unconscious brain is about 90% of who you are. And then finally, it's a brain that is almost impossible to control. In other words, if you're in a room full of people and you tell them don't panic, and they see smoke coming out of the window or the door, then of course everybody will panic. So here is the puzzling discovery. Now, look at those two different columns, right? We know now for sure that the primal brain drives the behavior of people. In fact, not only did Kahneman got the Nobel Prize in 2002, but one of his students, a guy by the name of Richard Thaler, got the Nobel Prize in 2017 for it. And he was one of his students, right? The book that Thaler wrote is called Nudge. It's a very interesting book because it's a lot easier to read than Kahneman's book. Anyway, so I'd like to now give you a series of experiments that will prove that you guys are red times. So the first one is really a typical optical illusion, but you may not have seen that one, right? And the question is, between the square labeled A and the square labeled B, which one is darker? So do you believe that A is darker than B?
I do, but I know you're going to trick me.
Right, yeah, I'm going to trick you. So no, look, I am not changing anything, right? Look, I'm just bringing a single shade of gray in the middle. But A and B are strictly identical. If you use a spectrometer, they measure exactly the same intensity of gray. Yet guess what? Everything in your brain tells you otherwise, right? So you cannot even trust your own eyes. All right, let's do this one here. A cookie plus a candy equal $1.10. We know that the cookie is $1 more than the candy. The question is, how much is the candy? How much is the cookie?
I know this one.
All right. So most likely you jumped to the conclusion that the candy was 10 cents and the cookie was $1, but that's not the right answer, because then the difference is only 90 cents. So the right answer is 105, 5 cents, 110. But you know, even if you really are good in mathematics, most likely your primal brain made you jump quickly, fast, right, to the wrong conclusion. Now, this is the one that got Kahneman the Nobel Prize in economy. So you'll see how simple and profound this particular experiment is. And this, by the way, justify why it is hard to sell. So you guys are gonna have to make two bets, and in each bet, you're gonna get two options. So in the first bet, you have option A, which is you can win $5,000 for sure, or in option B, we can flip a coin, and depending where the coin will land, you can win 10,000 or zero. Now, from a statistical perspective, because you have 50% chance to win in option B, those two options are statistically the same, right? But what would you choose? And be honest, you know, don't overthink it. Imagine you are faced with the option. What would you choose? So, Michael, what would you choose?
I'd probably choose option A, just because I'm, you know, a bird in hand.
Right. So, in fact, Kahneman did that test with hundreds or thousands of people, and 95 to 97% of the population would choose option A. Now, this is where it's going to get interesting. Now, you guys are going to have to make a second bet. In this second bet, you can lose $5,000 for sure. In other words, if you choose option A, you're going to have to give me $5,000. Or we can flip a coin. You can choose option B, but of course, it's going to cost you twice as much if you lose. What would you choose?
Option B.
All right. So again, 97% of the population would choose option B. And as you can tell, it doesn't make sense. In other words, if our brain was a logical machine, at least we would be symmetrical. So congratulations, you've just discovered one of the 188 cognitive biases, which again are driven by our primal brain. And this one, do you know how it's called, Michael?
Again?
Do you know the name of that cognitive bias?
No. Loss aversion or something?
Yeah, exactly. It's called the loss aversion bias. In fact, some researchers went as far as quantifying that loss aversion bias, and it makes for an interesting discussion, but the loss aversion bias is in average, so it's a very complicated average, but in average, it's equal to 2.3. And let me explain what that 2.3 means. But that 2.3 is really critical for anybody to understand when you're trying to sell something, because that explains why it's hard to sell. Now, I don't know if you believe, guys, that it's hard to sell, but I've been in sales and marketing my entire life. I sold multi-million dollar supercomputers, so things which cost, you know, $10 million all the way to $300 million. And I always found that it was very difficult. Why is it that it's so difficult to persuade people when you try to sell them something? And the reason is here. It's because of that 2.3 factor. Here is what it means. So imagine, you know, I am trying to sell this pen here to Michael. And imagine this pen is worth $2.3. So if we human beings were not afflicted by the loss aversion bias, we could predict that Michael would be willing to pay $2.3 for this. Why? Because it's a win-win solution. It's a fair trade, right? On one hand, he receives the pen, which is worth $2.3. On the other hand, he opens up his wallet and gives me $2.3. The problem is losing $2.3 of value for Michael creates a negative emotion which is much stronger negatively than the positive emotion of receiving that pen. So researchers would normally predict then that to receive $2.3 of value, Michael is only willing to pay $1 out of his pocket. So here is what it means, right? Whenever you're selling a car, for example, if you're selling a Toyota, your customers in their mind, they are expecting to drive a Porsche, right? They are expecting, whatever it is you're selling at that price, they're always expecting to receive 2.3 times that amount of value. And that explains why it's hard to sell.
That's pretty cool.
So here is another experiment. I'm going to ask you to take a piece of paper, and you're only going to get 5 seconds per line. So take a piece of paper and a pen, and just be ready to write. It's important that you have to write the results here. So it's going to go very quick. But you have to be honest because it's an interesting test. Ready? So here we go. What is the result of 2048 multiplied by 2? What is the result of 4096 now multiplied by 2? Write down the name of a tool. Or think of a tool, and remember, write down the name of a color. Stop. Now, so what do you think is the probability that possibly over between 50 and 75% of the people who are listening now would come on with the same tool and the same color? So I know we cannot see all these videos, so it's gonna be hard to verify my assumption here. But again, my question is, what do you think is the probability that many people would come up with the same tool and the same color? Normally, it should be very low because you could choose a lot of different tools, lots of different colors. But in reality, how many people chose either a blue or a red hammer? So again, I cannot see your video, so I get, we have Michael with a blue or a red hammer.
We are red hammer.
Right, red hammer. And guess what? Red hammer. See, here we go. We have more of it. So I've done this test in front of 2,000 people, and when you do it, and you have over 1,000 people that raise their hand, everybody look in the room and they go, how did he do it, right? Well, why is that? It's because you guys are way more predictable than you think. In other words, all your thinking, all your behavior, all yourself is really driven by your primal brain. All right, so let's do another test now with what I call the narrative bias. So I'd like everybody to imagine a large, bright yellow lemon. And it's a perfect, absolutely perfect yellow lemon. Now imagine slicing this lemon in half with a very sharp blade. So now close your eyes and really imagine holding that half lemon in your left hand and slicing a quarter inch slice of that lemon with a perfect knife. Now drop the knife and slowly bring that slice of lemon under your nose. Now I'd like you to take a deep in breath, and really enjoy the fragrance of that zesty lemon. It's very sweet. And now you're bringing that lemon, by the way, it was in the fridge, so it's very cold, but you're bringing that slice of lemon between your two lips. So you're now deliberately taking a bite into the meat of that lemon, and you're experiencing the juice that reaches the back of your teeth and the tip of your tongue. So finally now, you're getting the whole experience of that slice of lemon. The freshness, the acidity, the sweetness of the juice, the smell of the lemon, and the enjoyable experience that this juice is creating in your mouth. So now open up your eyes and tell me what's happening in your mouth.
Saliva.
So you're salivating, right? Now, did you need to salivate? Did you have a slice of lemon in your mouth? No. So you knew there was no lemon in the real picture, right? However, if I told you the story of that lemon well enough, your primal brain was made to believe that you had lemon in your mouth, and therefore it had to prepare the juice for digestion, which means it triggered your salivary gland, right? Mm-hmm. So you see how easy it is to fool the primal brain around? Just a good story will do it. And oh, by the way, that explains why storytelling works in sales. Right? There is a science of why stories work, and it's all anchored in the primal brain. All right, let's do another experiment, and I'm going to be finished with that now. It's called the orientation bias. My question is this lady okay, other than being upside down? Yes, she looks okay. So I'd like you to turn your head around and try to look at her in the right dimension. Turn your leg around, turn your head around and look at her. In fact, it's pretty difficult. Are you starting to see that there is a problem? In fact, let me help you with the problem. Now this is, I did not change anything. I just rotated the image. In fact, no, she's not okay, right? However, did you notice that when she was upside down, you were completely incapable of telling what was wrong with her?
Oh, that's crazy.
Right? So, and we're going to do a last experiment here, which is called the neuron fatigue bias. Sorry. So, actually, you know what? I messed up with that. I was making some changes, so I cannot do this test. But let's do another one instead. This is for the parallelism bias. So, which of those two parts do you think is bigger?
It's got to be the same.
So the bottom at the bottom one looks a lot bigger than the first one, right? But in reality, they are not. They are strictly identical. This was discovered 70 or 80 years ago by a German scientist, right? But the bottom line is, do you realize how easy it is to fool people around, right? And why is that? Is because our brain is not an absolute device to gauge perception and to swallow information and to process information. Our brain today in 2020 is still impacted by our primal brain. So the key to human persuasion is this, it's to realize that it's not like we are a little bit irrational. We are totally 100% irrational. And in fact, you can summarize these 188 complex biases, you can explain them with the six stimuli to the primal brain. So I'm not going to go into this because if you guys have read the book, you know what those six stimuli are, right? But the six stimuli are that this primal brain is selfish. It's all about me. It can only deal with contrast, before, after, with, without, my solution, without my solution. It's tangible. It cannot deal with complex, abstract concept. In fact, reading, the primal brain cannot read. Reading is only a very recent activity that we've done only for the last 8,000 years, but your primal brain is 500 million years old. So by definition, the primal brain cannot really understand words. It needs to have stimulus that are memorable. In other words, if I tell you something and you forget it immediately, chances are what I will tell you will not persuade you at all. It's a brain that is visual, and finally, it's a brain that can only be triggered by emotion. Mathematics will not trigger the primal brain. Right? So everything we've done in my company for the last 20 years is based on understanding the primal brain, understanding that it can only be triggered by one of those six stimuli, and then applying these six stimuli to every steps of the sales and marketing process. So that was a long introduction, but I hope it was helpful. And so let's go back to a more of a Q&A portion if you want.
That was great, because you're right. I think all of us have read that we're reptilian. We know this, but we don't know this. Like, I think we've all read the books, or tried to, like you said. But I've read a million of these books, and then every time I see this, I'm like, fuck, I got to be doing this. So one of the big, you're going to go through the three, you know, steps, but application. I think a lot of us, I mean, Niraj does brain science, a lot of us do. We all read this stuff. But then, man, then when you get to doing your website or writing copy, it's like we just always forget.
But I think we're slowing down into the other brain when we're doing that activity.
Yeah.
So you're sitting in a different thought process because you think you're, you know, doing it slow and rationally.
Right.
Well, and it's even harder to sell it to a client who doesn't even understand that there are primal brains out there, right?
Yeah,
because if you just think linearly, you go, no, I need to use logic to try to persuade people. And of course, when you're an advertising agency, you know that every decision is made emotionally, but a lot of people still deny that.
I think people understand it intellectually, but then when we get to persuasion, we don't do this. So then how do you apply it? Or are the checklists you go through, or things to remind yourself as you're to get in a state to actually access the primal brain? Because I know I do this when I write copy. I go all heady, and then, you know, only like weirdos like it. So application, I think, is our biggest question of how to apply these in one to many communications. I think we could go in another time, talk about sales and when there's an interaction, but in one to many, like a website or a direct mail piece or a commercial or an ad, I think, how do you apply this? How do you do that?
So again, we've made it a little easier for people to apply that by translating those six stimuli into the four steps, right?
Yes.
And as you recall, the four steps, let me zoom to it. The four steps are this. In other words, that's the distillation column to help you figure out what you need to communicate to the primal brain. But because the primal brain is sensitive to personal information, it's all selfish. It doesn't care so much about what you want, what you need, but it only cares about me, me, me. So your job is to diagnose the pain. That's the first step. And you remember that if you order a home-delivered pizza, your pain has nothing to do with the pizza. It's all about the speed of the delivery or the anxiety of not knowing when the pizza will arrive. So
can somebody volunteer and have you help them diagnose the pain of their product?
Well, so when we say diagnose the pain, you have to understand it at two levels. You have to understand it at a marketing level, then you have to understand it at a sales level. At the marketing level, here is what it means. It means that if you're selling pizza, you should not sell the pizza, you should sell the delivery. In the case of Starbucks, so that's the example for Domino's, right? And that's why Domino came up with that slogan, 30 minutes or less, or it's free. Why? Because the number one pain of the average consumer of pizza in the US is the anxiety of not knowing when the pizza will arrive. So the bottom line of that, you know, the conclusion of that story is that fundamentally, Domino's is not in the pizza business. They are a FedEx organization which happened to sell pizza. But they've gone through that because they did a perfect, a really good diagnostic of the pain. Let me give you a second example of that. The other example, I like.
can we bring somebody else up so you can help them diagnose the pain so we can make it more interactive?
Let me get into it. I want to give you a second example, which is Starbucks, right?
Okay.
Starbucks is not in the coffee business. Why? Because the number one pain of the average drinker of coffee in the US is not having a transition between home and the office. So at Starbucks, they call that the third place. So in essence, Starbucks is a transitional environment between home and the office. So that's what they've done. They've hired smart marketing people that could diagnose that pain, not just at the level of the neocortex. In other words, not just at the level of the likes, the wants, of the needs, but really at the unconscious level of the pain, which are those negative emotions. So that's the marketing level. Now, luckily, 20 years ago, we started to see a new branch of marketing called neuromarketing. Why? Because traditional marketing, if you think about it, traditional marketing is about asking people, what do you want? But the problem is, if you ask them, what do you want? It's the wrong question, because you're only going to be poking in the tip of the iceberg here, what they are aware of. But the promise of neuromarketing is, we're not just going to ask people what you want, but as you said earlier on, we're going to put electrodes on their brain. We're going to put eye tracking system on their eyes. We're going to measure how electricity flows through their fingers. We're going to measure the emotion that they display on the screen based on how they contract the 43 muscles on their faces. We're going to put, you know, a sensor on their heart to check the heart rate, the breathing, all of that. All those physiological measurements are going to give us a more truthful measure of what they really want as opposed to what they wish or what they like or what they want, right? So again, the promise of neuromarketing, which started 20 years ago, is to be able to dig deeper below the consciousness level. So that water level here is the consciousness level, right? Yep. So again, that's thinking of the step of diagnosing the pain as a marketing step. Now let's go into my second point here, which is, let's think about what does diagnose the pain means at the sales level. Here is what it means at the sales level, especially if you're face to face with a client. What does it mean? It means that 80% of the sales process, or the sales persuasion effect, is achieved not when you talk, but when you ask your customers questions. Think about it. When we are in sales, if I put my hat of a salesperson, I think that my best chances to persuade is when I talk to people, right? I'm going to tell them information to try to persuade them. But in reality, the people that are the most effective in persuasion, they don't tell people things. They ask them questions so that people will self-realize now that they don't want the pizza, right? They need a delivery, or their pain is they have that anxiety of that delivery. So the smart salespeople, they ask really critical questions, which makes the prospect believe and understand their situation from a new angle. And then, of course, then it would make sense for them to buy the solution from that person. I mean, think about it. The reason why also I use the word diagnose is because diagnose comes from the medical realm. Because we all love our doctors, and we would buy anything from our doctors, right? We would trust our doctors. So, but the doctor, remember that they don't sell us the aspirin. Right? When you walk into the office of a doctor, the doctor doesn't tell you, oh, you need to take two aspirin. The doctor is going to spend 80% of his time asking you questions about your condition. And once he's done with the diagnostic, but again, which represents 80% of his persuasion efforts, then he's only going to use 20% of his efforts to make sure that you will be taking the aspirin. So again, diagnose the pain works at two levels. It works at the marketing level to help this, you know, the salespeople figure out what's really going to drive the behavior of the customer. And then if you have a chance to meet with the client face-to-face, it means when you're face-to-face, you should spend 80% of your time diagnosing. Mm-hmm. So that's what diagnose the pain really means.
Okay.
Do you have any questions? I mean, I know I'm talking fast and I'm going left and right and backwards and forward.
I get it. We all get it theoretically, but what's the application? Well, I'm still looking for
it. I think that's why I was saying, if we could do it to a company that we know, like in the group, would be fun versus like a big company like you know,
Starbucks,
I think that would be a good exercise.
More fun to apply this as opposed to hear about it.
Once you understand the concept, so first of all, that concept of going from pain to, of going from want to pain is difficult for many reasons. First, again, you have the barrier of the consciousness level here at the level of the needs. So even the customer themselves may deny that they have that pain because they don't know it, right? And then if you're trying to sell and you always have the, I mean, you have your client and then you have the end user at the end. So the marketing team of the client may not even understand what you're trying to say here. So think about it. It's completely irrational. Imagine you're Domino's, right? And I am trying to sell you the idea that you're not in the pizza business, that you should not talk about pizza, but that you should talk about delivery. You may think I'm crazy. So the difficulty here is to help people understand the difference between a want and a pain. If you can do that, then life will be a lot easier.
So what are some techniques without putting my head under the EEG or galvanic skin response to difference to help find
the idea is then to show them examples. You tell them the story of Domino's. You tell them the story of Starbucks. And if they read the book, you know, there is a book by Howard Schultz where he talks about the third place. So the CEO of Starbucks tells you that he's not in the coffee business. He makes it very clear.
I'm not asking how to sell this theory. I'm asking if I'm a company and I'm trying to diagnose the pain, how do I do this? I mean,
you have two ways. You have two ways. Either you don't have the budget to do no marketing research. So you hire a VP of marketing who understands this really well, and he or she will be able to do the diagnostic by asking smart questions. In other words, there is some hope if you can do really good marketing by using the right question. Right? In other words, you can still try to dive into that iceberg of decision drivers here by asking questions. And that's what, if you think about it, that's what people with a PhD in psychology do. That's what shrinks do, right? The shrink, when they put you on a yellow couch and they make you in a relaxed situation, they put a little bit of smooth music in the background, they make sure you're warm enough, and they ask you, so when you're thinking about this product, what's the first impression that you have, right? What they are trying to do is they are trying to poke into your unconsciousness by making you comfortable so that these drivers come to the surface.
You hire neuromarketing firm, but assuming you're not going to do it, what are some techniques to get to the core pain?
That's the first technique. The second technique is hire a neuromarketing firm that's going to put electrodes on the brain of people. You have other techniques, by the way. Have you heard of the implicit test or the implicit association test? It's called IAT, implicit association test. So what you can do to poke into that unconscious brain is you display two concepts with people and you measure to what degree people associate one concept with the other and they do not associate a third concept with the other one. In other words, when you try to engage your neocortex is always slower. So the implicit association test is based on the speed of association that you can make. So for example, if I want to figure out if I like a concept or I don't, or I want a pizza and et cetera, I would show a slice of pizza and I would show a slow car, right? Or a bicycle, because we know that the bicycle is slow. And then I would show that same pizza and a fast car so that it's gonna imply that the delivery is gonna be faster, right? Well, we are going to be able to figure out that people have an association with fast delivery of that pizza by the speed at which they will be able to connect the pizza with the fast delivery when it will take them longer to associate the bicycle with the, because the bicycle is going to be slower delivered, right? So you don't even need to use expensive, these IAT tests, by the way, it's free. I mean, you have tools on the web today that are 100% free to do these implicit association tests. Okay. So the price goes from super cheap, zero, all the way to using an fMRI, and the typical study using an fMRI was only a dozen subjects is going to be in the hundreds, if not 200s of thousands of dollars. Right? So people can use all these so-called neuromarketing techniques, which again start with the implicit association test, which is super cheap. Now, the difficulty though is a lot of people that have done this neuromarketing research, they are not using a model of persuasion. So if you do not put all your findings in the framework of the two brains, then people usually don't know what to do with the result of those research. I've seen countless research where people said, well, this is what we found in the, and then what? How do you activate it? Well, if you can put it in the concept of, in the context of, well, this is what the neocortex wants, this is what the primal brain wants, then it makes much more sense. It clarifies a lot of things.
Well, yeah, I mean, I get the model. We just want to see more application. I understand, yeah, the answer, I mean, I understand, sure, that we can hire neuromarketing firm. That's not what we're trying to get to this webinar. We want to, like, do something here. How can we get, so there's an implicit test. There's no other way online, you're saying, to apply any of this without hiring, you know, without this?
So online, you're starting to get another tool online, which is called eye tracking. So eye tracking has been around for almost 20 years. And you can get online tools now. In other words, as soon as people have a camera in front of them and you calibrate the camera to figure out where their eyes are going, you can do the eye tracking online for very cheap. Right? But again, then you need to decide what you want to track their eyes on and figure out which one of your two stimulus will be more impactful on them, right? So again, without the benefit of having a model of persuasion, for most people, it's not very useful.
So how do you make it useful?
Yeah, this is.
I guess that's the question. If you're running a company and you're directing your marketing and sales department and trying to, I read your book. I get into the neuroscience. I want to know how I can bring experiments, tests, and new ideas to a marketing team without hiring a.
Online, as I told you before, this is what we are.
You want your cookie and you want to eat it at the same time. There is a cause. There is a barrier to understanding all this.
Yeah.
Right.
But I'm sure you have people who come up with tests. Like if you say, Domino's, it's not the pizza, it's the delivery.
If you're a customer, you also have a third solution, which is to hire a coach who understands all this, right? And you're just going to use his experience to guide you towards deciding what's the real pain. You know, we have this with our client all the time. You know, I do an iceberg of decision driver with our clients and they sell very complicated stuff. Sometimes I don't even understand what they sell, but they ask me, so Patrick, you've done this for thousands of companies. What do you think the real pain is? And very often I say, I don't think you want to get my opinion because my opinion is one guy who is not, 100% American, he's still half French. And my experience is that of a 60-year-old male. And if your clients are a 50-year-old female, then I'm not the right guy to tell you. So there are ways around. And of course, using people with experience is very often the best way because you get a lot of shortcuts.
So what are some shortcuts to diagnose the pain and then move on to differentiating your claims?
Again, it all depends on your budget, how much time and how much money you want to do. You want to invest for that. If you want to invest very little money, maybe you do an IIT test, that's good. If you don't even want to go there with no marketing, do some smart marketing. At least ask the right question to your customers and try to figure out what their pain is based on their self-reported responses. If you do that, think about it. No marketing did not exist 20 years ago. So that doesn't mean that all the marketing that was done prior to no marketing was completely useless. In fact, Domino's did all their marketing strategy 40 years ago. There was no, but you know, they were able to find out what the pain was intuitively. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is the best people to diagnose the pain are not VP of marketing, they are psychologists. So maybe you need to hire a psychologist on your team. So I'm sorry, I don't have a magic answer to give you, but I'm giving you a solution that goes from super cheap all the way to, if you want to do a real study to get there, the best one is still to use an fMRI, but it costs an arm and a leg, and it's very long. Yeah, it's a long time.
So you assume, though, when you're diagnosing a pain, at the very least, that it's a primal pain, right? So you know you're on the wrong track when the pain you've diagnosed isn't a primal pain, right? So at, least, at the very least, we can eliminate pains we're going for, right?
Right.
So it, maybe there's got to be a way to think about this, man.
Without definition, you know, by definition, a pain needs to be a negative emotion.
Okay.
Why? Because remember that the primal brain can only be triggered by emotions. So remember also that when Domino's articulated it, right? So we know what the product is, a slice of pizza. But the pain that Domino solves is the anxiety of not knowing when the pizza will arrive. And when I say that, I know I'm using several words, right? Anxiety of not knowing when the pizza will arrive. But you should be able to clearly pinpoint where that emotion is, right? I mean, you should be able to really feel it more from the heart than the brain. In the case of Starbucks, the emotion of the absence of transition between home and the office. So again, you have to dig deeper into your own psyche and try to experience for yourself what that means, you know, not to have a transition between home and the office. Why? Because when you're at home, you're thinking, what do I have in my fridge? At what time do I have to pick up the kids? All of that. When you're in the office, you're thinking, well, you know, I have 27 voicemails. I have to prepare 2 proposals. I have a meeting with a client. And for most people, not having a transition between those two worlds, they need a buffer time. Not having that buffer time in between creates a negative emotion. And that's what Starbucks called the absence of transition.
Okay.
So again, if you cannot clearly spell out the pain with something which sounds and feel and tastes and experiences like an emotion, then chances are it's not a pain.
Got it. So.
And I can give you an example, because the most common objection is it's too expensive, or I want to buy a cheap product. But cheap product is not an emotion.
Right.
In fact, if everybody had that pain, everybody would use the cheapest shoes. They would wear they would watch the cheapest TV. They would wear the cheapest shoes. Yeah. They would buy the cheapest Coca-Cola, whatever. But in reality, people don't always buy the cheapest product. Now, there is only one company today which has the highest level of marketing strategies focused on that. And it's Walmart, right? It's the only company that's focused on having the cheapest prices. It's Walmart. But it's a very dangerous situation, because right now, Amazon is eating their lunch.
I understand. Okay, so let's get to it. So it has to be a primal pain of some sort. And I'm thinking now, we can split test, right? So I can make assumptions, right? We can also put on each other's shoes about primal pain that the product might solve. Now, let me run this by you. So I could then run a series of split tests. I could make 6 different stages addressing with imagery, assume imagery, right? Because we're doing primal. So also from what you said before, you're saying imagery or video or something like that is going to be way more powerful to the primal brain than like a paragraph of copy.
Well, by the way, the paragraph copy, when you do an IAT test, if you do an implicit association test, you can only use 1 word or 2-3 words maximum.
Good. Got
after it. That, right? Or better, use an image, as you said, yeah.
I'm not even talking about that. So I do 6 split tests, and I could then run that, you know, to a randomized audience, and I could test for time on site, whether they scroll down, right? So wouldn't you think I'd be able to get to this through testing, right? So you're saying imagery of the, maybe I hypothesize 5 different pains that we've all met about, right? So then I can go online, I could do images, get a good like psychological image maker, couple words, and all I'm testing for, and then I write the rest of my sales page with the differentiate my claims.
Right, it does seem like
this is very doable online with our technique.
Because there's this 4-step process, but step 1 is the one that the limitations you keep bringing up of hiring a neuroscientist, doing those. Like, is there a way that people who aren't Domino's or Starbucks with limited budgets, but smart marketing folks could create some assumptions and test those
exactly
with results?
I'll make the assumptions. This is all doable with our skill set.
Yeah. It seems like step two, three, and four are very, pretty straightforward.
So I would split up six different pages, and who would I find to go? And then I just make other like five dominant pain themes, right, that we could then take, right, to test. And we do imaging, and we could actually find real results based on behavior online with our shit.
Right. So you can use each here for the pain, but you could use some of those techniques also for the claim afterwards.
Right.
Because what you can do is you can do it with your competitors, right? Mm-hmm. So that process that you would use, so assume you would have five pain which you think are driving the behavior of people really, right?
Yeah.
You could compare those five with one, or you could rank those five pains all together. So at the end of the day, you would have pain number one all the way down to pain number five. Yeah. And then you can repeat the same thing for branding concepts, right? You know, you could compare your product with the product of your competitors and figure out which one is associated with one concept more than the other. In other words, right now, Domino's could compare to which degree people believe they are a fast delivery company. They could compare it to Pizza Hut or whatever other competitors are.
So that
idea of doing a comparison by dichotomy can be applied to the notion of claims.
So you have the diet, we could probably test our way into figuring out the pain with behavior based on split test and time on site and whether they scroll down, and then also even whether they buy. And then the claims we could also test and associate them all with a certain pain, and then also in relationship with our customers, right? With our competitors.
Right.
And then demonstrate the gain. Let's go to that.
So on the gain, you could do the same thing as well. In other words, you could present people an image of the gain or different images of the gain, and you could ask them, so when you buy from those guys, do you get more value with that or more value with that?
Got it. So I'm looking at a way to apply it without the test. And sure, at a certain level, you do that the big brain thing. But I think you can get a lot of this.
Again, some of these concepts, you can ask people. You can just do a regular survey or focus group and ask people. Again, the danger of simply using their self-reported answers is that they might think they know what they want, but in reality, they don't know what their pains are.
I am curious if anyone else who's on here who's read this book or messed around with any of this has tried any of their own self-hack ways of trying to do this. I have a feeling like
Dan Clark, when he owns Brain FM, he's on the call, and he says it helps. We do a lot of testing using MTurk. There's a ton of tools and services that use that to help remove the biases. So it looks like there's some things to test with. Yeah, I just wanted to run through an example going through it, you know, a product that one of us has using these kind of techniques.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good. I'm going to get Dan Clark on video. Yeah, let's put Natalie, put Dan on video.
Yes.
There he is. Hey, Dan.
Dan. Let me just switch my microphone real quick. It's probably better now. Cool. So there's a few different services. Like, we use MTurk for all of our musical testing. So what we're doing is we do Sartas while they're listening to music, and then we score them as they're doing it. One of the things we started realizing is we can test copy and different kinds of things. So we get a psychographic profile of someone before they start their test. And then we're specifically, have buckets that we put them in, and then we say this is how the music performs on them, but this is also how copy is responding to them.
Nice.
I was just looking up, like, obviously, like, we have a PhD on staff and a psychologist, so it's probably not as doable, but there's a company called copytesting.com that does similar kinds of psychographics. It's only for A/B testing copy, but they give you buckets of your people. It's not as specific.
That's Pep LaJaw's company.
What was that?
That's Pep's company. I've actually beta tested that.
Oh, no way. Okay, cool. So you're very familiar. Yeah. So I'm assuming they use MTurk.
Yeah. Now that works. They give you like 20 people in your demographic, and you can test a copy and they comment and all that. It's pretty cool. They're like online accelerators of insight.
Yeah. Yeah. So because we were doing thousands of dollars of testing on Facebook, we stopped doing that, and then we realized that we actually are doing all this from a science side, and that there's no difference. So we were able to cut our development costs and our copy development costs by tens of thousands of dollars. Because for us, who have our own service and we have this person, It costs us like 3 cents per test. It's super cheap because we have the, you know, the people that are instituting it. So it maybe not be appropriate for everyone, but that's kind of how we're doing it.
That's with MTurk?
Yeah, that's through Amazon's MTurk.
That's pretty cool. Do you guys use that or any of those kind of testing? Or I think a lot of us here, it's not that we would never do the neuromarketing in that way, but at the beginning, we want to use as many insights from what you're learning because there are like heuristics based on your work, right? So you've been doing this for 20 years. There are like, there's got to be.
I think people in the group would also get, they're very entrepreneurial and they want to kind of self-experiment and figure things out before they hire it out. Yeah, okay. So you provide this framework and it's like, what are ways you can tinker and test so that when you go to hire someone or, you know, take it to that next step that you're like informed in your hypothesis.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to go in less than 2 minutes now. Do you guys have any other questions?
No, I think it's...
This is a great framework, and now it gives us the ability to try to figure out how we can...
Apply it,
yeah.
Okay, really very good. So I hope you found that it was time well invested on your end, and you guys know where to find me, so...
Oh, for sure.
Hope we'll run into each other very soon again.
Yes.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Cheers. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.